Comments on Cerotech Tech Chats are those of the individuals and do not represent Cerotech Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers. Welcome to the latest Cerotech Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of Cerotech Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. And now, here's your host, Michael Loft. And welcome to Cerotech Tech Chat 105 for June 9, 2011. This is Michael Loft. Our topic tonight is improving the quality of your sleep. This discussion is sponsored by Vanda Pharmaceuticals, currently conducting a clinical research study for a new medication called Tasimeltian, and we'll be talking about that tonight with the goal of helping to improve or create normal sleep for individuals who have difficulty with that. Representing Vanda Pharmaceuticals this evening is our guest, Mr. William Hughes. We thank you, sir, for joining us tonight, sir.
Thank you, Michael. It's good to be here.
Yes. Also joining us is Joseph Hull, Ph.D., the Division of Sleep Medicine, Harvard Medical School, and the Brigham and Women's Hospital located in Boston, Massachusetts. Thank you for joining us again, Joe.
Thank you, Michael, for having me on.
Well, you may have heard these two gentlemen earlier on our podcast. We talked about what they would be offering, and so tonight we're going to talk about sleep difficulties and problems that people are having, and we're going to offer some suggestions on improving the quality of sleep, because that's at the end of the day what we ultimately need to do. And I guess really one of the first things we're going to start with is both Joe and William. I'll start with you, Joe. Kind of explain the biggest problem, I guess, summing it up, is what we call a non-24-hour sleep-wake cycle, where our body is a little bit more, usually a little bit more than 24 hours, so that we get out of sync. So kind of explain that so we have a foundation to grow from here.
So the name of the sleep disorder is referred to as a non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder. They call it a non-24-hour because it's in relation to the body clock. Our body clock is usually cycles and has a 24-hour, about a 24-hour timing. It's usually a little bit longer than 24 hours. Light exposure to the eyes, the rising and setting of the sun, usually resets it every day in sighted individuals. But in an individual who is totally blind, at least in a majority of them, let's say a little bit over 50% as far as we can tell so far, may experience this non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder, which is the symptoms of it can be difficulty sleeping at night, as far as trouble falling asleep, and also remaining asleep during the night, and then also experiencing daytime sleepiness. But the main part of this disruption is it recurs. So the individual may have periods where they're sleeping okay and they're alert during the day for a few days to maybe a week or so, and then again they start to feel a difficulty sleeping at night and remaining awake in the afternoon and evening hours. And this disruption may last for a few months and then reoccur where they actually can sleep again and don't have much trouble for a few nights or for a week or so, and then the problem reoccurs. And this could be continuing throughout their life ever since they've lost their light perception. So that's the main gist of what this disorder can look like or what a person could experience.
So it could be that or other things. So I guess maybe we should talk about some specific sleep disorders that we as a society have. And there's a lot of things. I mean, there's sleep apnea, there's RLS, restless leg syndrome. Someone had actually asked us about bipolar disorder, if that would disqualify them from a sleep study or that would present issues, or just common elements that are in our lives, things like pets or lighting or leaving the TV on or maybe noises. Maybe you have a noisy family or have neighbors that have a sound system with a big subwoofer that they like to play. So let's talk about some of the common factors beyond
sure.
the 24-7.
When we're thinking of sleep disorders, in general, every sleep disorder basically they all have the same similar symptoms, just like the non-24-hour that I just described, which is also the same thing that a person experiences with jet lag. there's always some problem with difficulty sleeping. It's not so much that you can't sleep. It's the effects of not being able to sleep at a desired time that affect your functioning during the daytime. And this is what concerns many sleep clinicians, is that it's not so much that you're not getting the sleep, it's affecting your awake, your function during the time that you're awake in the daytime trying to do work. People who work night shifts have something that we call that is a kind of like a jet lag, but it's more of a night shift sleep disorder, where you're sleeping during the night, or you're awake during the night during your work shift when your body clock is signaling sleep. And then when you return home, you try to sleep during the day, but because the body clock sends a wake signal during the later part of the day, you only get maybe 4 or 5 hours of sleep during the day. So night shift workers have this common sleep disorder where their sleep is disrupted when they're trying to sleep because they're sleeping at the wrong biological time. Sleep apnea is another one in which when a person is falling asleep at a certain stage of sleep, your muscle tone within your airway relaxes, and when the air is sucked into your lungs, the airway collapses, and the walls of the airway suck together, blocking the flow of air going in and out of your lungs. Although your lungs may try to continue to take in air, they're unable to because of this blockage, and your brain picks this up because of increasing CO2 levels, because no new oxygen is coming into your body, and you wake up frequently. You may have 100 awakenings, and waking up every night, it's almost like it's equivalent to someone just standing next to your bed and poking you awake every 30, every minute or so. And because of having that disruption of sleep, it makes you very tired during the daytime. Restless leg syndrome is similar, in which people have this uncontrollable urge to move their extremities, and this can have a huge impact on the person's ability to fall asleep. And it may inadvertently actually wake them from sleep. We also think of psychological things that can affect sleep as far as stress. Stress can have a huge arousing effect on a person, making it difficult for them to sleep. And then even your behavior of watching television in your bedroom or doing things that you would actively do somewhere else, when you're doing these things in your bedroom, you actually start to relate to those activities in the bedroom, which can affect you psychologically and the ability to fall asleep. Lighting and noise is usually another factor that can affect how well someone can fall asleep. And it may even affect their ability to wake up early in the morning because they may stay up for a little bit longer, get too much light, and that might inadvertently make them sleep in a little bit longer. And bipolar disorder, a lot of psychological disorders have been related to certain sleep disruption. Chronic insomnia is one in which certain people, usually sometimes bipolar disorder or manic depressants, may exhibit insomnia-like symptoms where they're actually wide awake during the night and have difficulty sleeping. That usually is not studied so much, but that's the gist of some of those things.
So how important is exposure to sunlight or getting artificial lighting somehow? How important is that to keeping us in check? In fact, I'm told if we don't have that, we would totally lose our concept of day and night.
Yeah, so your body's internal world has its own clock, and that clock needs to be set with the clock that in the time zone that you live in. There's certain body systems that are being turned on during certain parts of your biological day with inside you. So in the times that you're awake, your gastric juices in your stomach are being produced, your heart rate is increased, your blood pressure is increased, and certain parts of your brain are activated by wake centers in your brainstem. And then in the nighttime hours, everything starts to kind of ramp down, and your sleep centers start to turn on, the gastric juices in your stomachs are not produced as much, your heart rate decreases, your blood pressure decreases, your body temperature starts to decrease. And these cycles, the internal world of your body doesn't understand what's going on in the outside world. So it needs a certain neural input to tell it. And this is conveyed through the eyes. through a separate pathway, different from the visual pathways, but it does use the initial visual pathway of the retina and the optic nerve to translate the information of time of day. So when the sun rises, that signals the body clock to understand that it is now the daytime, and this is when it should be performing, it should be signaling the rest of their brain to perform wake certain processes that are done during wake for the rest of the day during the sun, during when the sun is up. And then in the night, all the nighttime processes occur. But if I were to take a sighted individual and have them live in a cave for months, or I covered their eyes, they would no longer get this signal anymore, which can happen to people who have complete loss of vision, either by having their both eyes enucleated or the retinal damage or optic nerve damage that completely disrupts the signal from getting from the retina to the body clock.
Okay, so what type of lights should we use to accomplish this? Are there special bulbs or special light box? Or how would we accomplish this if sunlight weren't an easy option for us?
Well, unless if your eyes are damaged to the point that the signal doesn't get through, a light box would not help you. In certain populations where people are bedridden, such as people who may be diagnosed with Alzheimer's, they live in nursing homes, there may not be a lot of indoor light or light that they're getting because the building is pointed, the window that they're at is a dark area outside, covered with trees, so they don't get a lot of light coming in the window. For populations in which they don't naturally get sunlight or readily enough artificial light in the place that they're situated, light boxes have been shown to help these people at least feel a little bit more alert during the day. Sometimes it helps with sleep. It kind of helps regulate how well they may sleep as well. But it can also help affect mood. A lot of people with winter depression have used what they call phototherapy. Usually in the winter months when the days are shorter, so there's more darkness during the majority of the day, they will use light boxes in the evening or early morning hours to get more light than they would naturally get just by the natural light-dark cycle to help enhance their mood.
Okay, so what would be the best time for this exposure? Is this something we would do kind of first thing in the morning to tell our body, hey, it's morning?
It's kind of, usually our body clocks are a little bit slower. It usually takes them another extra half hour to complete a cycle. And so to get the right proper adjustment to resync your body clock with a 24-hour day, usually the light in the morning on average is what most human beings, we believe, they need that light in the beginning of the day. But there are some people who have clocks that are a little bit faster, so they finish a complete cycle a little bit less than in 24 hours. So they require some light, more light at the end of the day to resync themselves so that they don't drift into an earlier time internally with relative to the 24-hour day.
Hey, Joe.
Yes.
You're talking a bunch about the body clock and kind of what it does. And I've heard people, when they ask me, they ask, they almost are asking questions about, is the body clock really real? Is it really that strong? Is it really that powerful in controlling our sleep and our wake? You talk some about your gastric juices and just some of the things that it does. I mean, I know you got your PhD studying a lot of this stuff, especially in the blind. I'm just curious if you had any comments on like how kind of powerful the circadian rhythm and the body clock really is, and why when it's not working right, as in non-24-hour, it causes problems for individuals.
So, for instance, some of the individuals that have participated in my studies, they do a home study in which we ask them to collect urine samples for about a 48-hour period each week. And they usually collect about 10 samples, and what we look for is a hormone called melatonin. And melatonin we use as kind of like looking inside the body to peer in to figure out what time it is. And the melatonin rhythm that we look at is very much controlled by the body clock. The timing of the release of this hormone is specifically controlled by the the body clock, which is called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. It's deep within the brain, and it sits just above the optic nerves where they crisscross inside the brain. And when these subjects do these samples and we get the results back, simultaneously the subjects are also keeping sleep diaries. And in a lot of the studies that we've done, anytime anybody is awake during the time that this melatonin hormone is peaking, so usually it will rise, peak, and then fall, and usually it has high levels for about 10 hours. And we usually notice in anybody, either sighted or blind, if we have them awake during the time that this melatonin is rising and peaking, this is usually determined as or called the biological night. This is when all those biological processes that are normally turned on during the waking day or the biological day when melatonin is not being released, this is when those systems shut down. And so even though the subjects don't know this is happening internally inside them, when they do their sleep diaries, when the melatonin is occurring during the night, when it usually is seen in sighted subjects, their sleep doesn't seem as disrupted. Their ability to fall asleep is usually typical, where it's about 15 minutes it takes them. And then they usually sleep throughout the night on these nights when their melatonin is occurring during the night. But since light can't always, since in many of the subjects that I've studied, the light doesn't reset their clock, the timing of the melatonin release occurs later and later each day. And on average, it's about a half hour later each day. So as the melatonin moves out of the nighttime and starts to be released in the morning hours, and then as the weeks progress, it starts to be produced in the afternoon and the evening, what happens is a complete disruption of the person's sleep at night. Even when I ask them to stay in bed for 8 hours and try to sleep, they are unable to when this melatonin is being, when their internal melatonin production is occurring during the daytime hours. They'll fall asleep for about 4 hours, but then they're wide awake for the last 3 or 4 hours that I've asked them to stay in bed. They usually will pick a time such as 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. And then also they will feel when this melatonin, the internal melatonin production is occurring in the daytime, they will begin to feel very, very sleepy and tired. And lots of times people have told me they've fallen asleep on the phone. They've fallen asleep during meetings at work or right in a conversation with someone, they've fallen right to sleep. And the influence of sleep pressure that can hit a person when this is occurring, and it's just like jet lag. Even a sighted person can experience this. If I went to England right now, it's about 3 a.m. in England, where it's only 9:30 here in Boston. If I went to England, I would experience the same difficulty of trying to sleep during the nighttime and be awake during the daytime in England. So we found in doing tests in people, when we had them come in the lab, we have them do reaction time tests and adding numbers, and when we have them doing these cognitive tests, we find that they perform very poorly during the times when we see that their melatonin production is occurring during those times, but when they're during that biological night. But if we have them performing during the biological day and their melatonin is being released during the sleep episode, then they perform very well. And we've seen this in sighted and blind subjects all across the board. This is something that's a very significant impact. And we do a lot of research looking at the astronauts on the space station, because this can happen to them, night shift workers, even interns working in hospitals who work long 36-hour shifts, and they're doing operations at 4 o'clock in the morning. So the circadian system affects everybody in our society when proper precautions are not taken, or our behavior is not the typical behavior of sleeping at night or being awake during the day, and we can be significantly influenced and negatively because we're unable to remain alert and awake during the desired time that we decide to wake or work. So it's a very important aspect that we should keep in mind.
Okay, and I think that's one of the things about it, is that, you know, those are some really interesting examples of the power of it, and the examples in the lab, and the examples of shift work, and the examples of jet lag, and astronauts are all things where you know, it's taking people outside of their schedule, and that's somewhat anticipated result. And I think the thing about it that's with non-24-hour and in the blind is it's their body doing it kind of just as the normal course of how the body works and due to the lack of light. And so it's one of those that it's not taking it out of a normal schedule, but it's happening in that flip-flop of people trying to sleep when their body's telling them it's daytime, and the disruption that comes about it, I think, is some of what you described.
Yes. And a lot of the, you know, sleep research has now grown exponentially over the last 3 or 4 decades. And people usually ask me, why didn't they ever do sleep research in the, you know, in the 1800s or the 1700s? And the main thing is that, you know, sleep disorders weren't very prevalent. Narcolepsy was known at the time, and certain other sleep disorders. But as far as in society, people getting less sleep for so many different reasons, like night shift work, we can thank the light bulb for helping promote shift work and night shift work in 24, you know, around the clock 24-hour operations, where people are getting less sleep and are becoming more tired. And a lot of times people think that this may affect even metabolism, which may increase a person's weight, which might have effects on the risk of heart disease and hypertension, and then developing other sleep disorders like sleep apnea, and then decreasing even more sleep that you have, causing a reoccurring cycle where sleep is affecting your whole physiology and your health.
Okay, later we'll talk about tasimelteon specifically and what Vanda Pharmaceuticals is trying to do, or what they are doing, seeking FDA approval and getting some folks to assist them in accomplishing that. But before we go there, let's talk about, in the last few years, the big rage has been melatonin. Well, the body produces melatonin, so if we just give our body a melatonin supplement, maybe we can switch it into going to bed at 10 p.m. or midnight if we want. So a few questions on that, Joe. First of all, from your standpoint, is melatonin still considered dangerous within the medical community? I mean, when we talked about this back in, I don't know, the late 90s, the feeling was, well, it's artificial, it's synthetic, it's made from cows, you can't trust it, maybe it's good, but if you don't get it from the right source, where is the medical community even on its use?
Yeah, there was a big craze in the 80s and 90s about melatonin and it having all these amazing effects, especially it was treated as a soporific substance where it would help promote sleep. And a lot of people thought, oh, you know, as you get older, you stop producing as much melatonin when you get older as you did as when you were young, but that's not true. And then a lot of people know that it's very common as we age, our ability to sleep, it seems, or the likelihood that we'll sleep 8 hours is less likely than when we at the age of 70 compared to when we were 20 years old. This is known fact in the research. We're still trying to figure out why that is, but I've seen a lot of blogs and information about, even like on the bottles of melatonin, over-the-counter melatonin, that this is, you know, as you get older, you produce less melatonin, and if you take more melatonin, it'll help you sleep better, because they make the connection that less melatonin means that you're going to sleep less. But that's not really the case. And as far as its safety, or at least its use in the scientific community, it's not really prescribed by doctors to help with sleep problems. And as far as it being helpful as a sleep aid, it has always been shown from many studies that it doesn't help promote sleep. But we do know that it does affect the body clock. There are receptor sites or parts of the body clock that will react to the melatonin that you take, that you administer yourself. They've done these in animal studies, and there have been some studies done in humans, especially in blind studies by a group in Oregon. And even my mentor, Dr. Stephen Lackley, has done studies in blind individuals using this kind of over-the-counter melatonin to see if he can actually signal the clock and reset it. And he was able to do that in at least half of his subjects, but not all of them. And the idea is that this over-the-counter melatonin does have significant effects, but they're not as strong as the effects of light. And that's basically the one thing that we've been trying to come up with, is a medication or the like that can actually reset the clock in the instance of where light no longer can have an impact, as with a person who has a total retinal optic nerve degeneration or their eyes have been removed. So,
are there any thoughts then on what is a reasonable dosage? I know Dr. Timothy Johnson, who's respected as a medical correspondent for ABC, said don't go over 300 milligrams, but yet we see people using 500, 750, 1, 1.5, even 3 milligrams, which seems...
I didn't even know there was 300 milligrams out there.
Yeah, I don't think they make it that small. So I'm curious, did Dr. Lockley find there was a point of overdose or overkill or...
There's never been enough research done on dosage.
That should it be time. So will we know that if it should even be time release that helps people stay asleep, where otherwise maybe they sleep 3-4 hours and yet they're up the rest of the night? Or maybe one of the big questions are, if people are using melatonin, how to determine the best time to begin taking it? Because I assume your objective is to take it when your sleep is the way you want it. That one night when you go to bed and get up at the exact time that you like and you feel great and it's all good, that's the time that you want to start it. And then you'd have to be consistent and take it that way every night and then hope that you're one of the small percentage of people that it actually works on and keeps the time clock where it's supposed to be or where you want it to be.
Yeah, the idea of, well, I'll at least tell you the research that they've done and how they did it. As far as like Dr. Lockley's assessments, he would do these field studies in the individuals and actually he would actually have them do these urine samples every week, and he would determine how long it would take for the individual's melatonin production to occur in the nighttime from the point from which he started. So in the first week, if he noticed that the melatonin was being produced at 12 o'clock, he would then look at the next few samples to see what's the average timing of their clock? So how long is it going to take them for the melatonin to delay its timing later and later each day until it starts to be produced in the night? And then by calculating the trajectory of that and guessing when that was going to occur, when the melatonin production would coincide with the desired sleep time at night, then he would start the individual on a regimen of melatonin where they would take an individual capsule about a half hour before bedtime. But in that was like a research study looking specifically at body clock timing and then figuring that out. So I never would tell anybody or suggest to anybody that they should just start taking melatonin over the counter. They should always speak to their doctor about that before they were to do that, because there really is no... The over-the-counter stuff is not regulated by the FDA in the United States. It is regulated, like, in the UK. So you have to get a prescription in the UK. And there's not much conclusive evidence about its safety, so especially when it's not regulated. So there's no control of what's going into those over-the-counter supplements of melatonin. So from that standpoint, you should always be careful.
Okay, so let's talk about some other things that many folks use, things that we do, substances consumed, and their effects. First of all, what about caffeine? I mean, should we limit the number of milligrams of caffeine or cut off its consumption at a certain time of the day to ensure that we can sleep at night?
Yeah, someone had told me, I think I may have said this the last time I was here, is that coffee beans are the second largest commodity on the market next to oil. And so that kind of shows you how, at least in the Western world, that shows you how much Western society needs to be, is not getting enough sleep because they're always so everybody's so tired. I see high school students now, I never drank coffee until after I went to college, and I see high school and middle school kids with Starbucks cups drinking that. And that just tells you that even the youth today are probably not getting enough sleep. And one of the problems is people may, especially students, young people, where their sleep systems are very, very healthy and they can sleep very well. They can sleep at any time of day, especially if they haven't had any sleep. And the problem with caffeine is that you really should just keep your consumption to the beginning of the day. When you take it at night, it can disrupt your sleep at night. We usually tell people not to consume any caffeine 6 hours before they go to bed. Because what will happen is if you have caffeine within that time, it will delay either how long it takes you to fall asleep, or it may screw up your sleep-wake cycles. The stages of sleep that you go into, there's usually a normal progression and cycle that occurs where you're in REM sleep and non-REM sleep. That cycles about every 90 minutes. But if you have frequent awakenings, which caffeine can cause, it disrupts the cycle, and then you don't feel as refreshed in the morning. And if you don't feel refreshed in the morning and restful, that means you're going to have caffeine again to wake you up. And if you have caffeine in the evening again, you're going to cause that cycle. And it just is a vicious cycle that you can create yourself just by taking caffeine. So just limit the caffeine to the beginning of the day.
Okay, just use it to jumpstart yourself and then control it from there. I want to talk about, you mentioned earlier some new research that's proven some really positive benefits of exercise, and not only the fact of exercise, but doing it at certain times of the day to keep your sleep normal, or even to use it to adjust, say, your traveling, as you mentioned, going to London, where you're moving yourself maybe 5 hours forward.
Yeah, there's been some research that has shown that exercise can have a significant impact on your body clock. And one of the research studies that we did here at the Brigham had shown that over so many nights of we had people exercise at a certain time of the day, and that was able to shift their body clock. And we had them do that over, I believe it was 8 days, and they actually were able to, on average, shift the person's body clock about 8 hours. As far as regulating people's sleep, there's a lot of disagreement at what time of day is the best. But usually I think in sighted individuals who keep a regular sleep-wake schedule, the earlier part of the day is usually the best part. But some people would probably disagree with me and tell me that the evening is better. And it may be even individualistic, where for one person it's not good for them in the morning and it's better in the evening. So there's not been a lot of research about whether the evening or the morning is better, because it could be the differences in people's body clock timing. Maybe someone has a faster than 24-hour cycle, where someone has a very slower than 24-hour. So they would need it at different parts of the day because of the different cycle length that they have.
Now, what are some psychological factors, even behavioral factors, that come into play that can mess up the sleep for us?
Well, like I said before, stress is a major can have a major impact on your ability to sleep well. A lot of everyday life things that could happen, especially if you lose your job or you lose a loved one, grief can have a major effect on that. Disease, people who have cancer or any other debilitating kind of disorders that significantly impact them, such as pain. You know, there's a lot of pain that can come with chemotherapy and some other diseases, and that can have a significant impact on how well you're going to sleep. I know in cancer, people with second or third stage cancer usually, because of the medications that they have to take, especially like steroids to stop their inflammation, that has a negative impact on their ability to sleep. And you had also mentioned even our behaviors, such as using our bedroom for other things other than sleep, can have an impact. I'm trying to think of some other things, such as alcohol. Drinking alcohol and staying up late and drinking alcohol. Alcohol can inhibit REM sleep, and REM sleep is a vital stage of sleep that we need during the night. So when you drink a lot of alcohol at night, you decrease the amount of REM you have, which can make you very tired the next day. So a lot of the foods that we eat, you have to be careful, because these can have a negative impact, particularly drugs such as alcohol.
What are some of the common prescription drugs that can cause problems? People take a drug to hopefully clear up some other ailment, only to find that it's affecting their sleep.
I know in Alzheimer's patients and other neurological disorders, this can have a significant impact on their sleep. the different medications that people have to take, especially in old age. As we get older, I told you, especially in healthy older adults, they usually sleep less than they did when they were in their 20s. But as we all know, as we get older, we're more likely to have other diseases or disorders that might occur in our older years, and that usually requires medication. And there's so many medications I can't even think of. Ones for urinary difficulties or stomach problems, ulcers, liver problems, cholesterol, all these medications that you see like being advertised. These can always have some kind of impact on your sleep-wake cycle, because some of them contain neurotransmitter chemicals that your own brain produces, and it can have an effect on those areas of your brain that control your sleep-wake center.
Okay, so what are some things we've learned in the last few years in particular that can help the blind community to help get better sleep and improve their productivity?
Well, I think the most important is that if a person who is blind does have difficulty sleeping, one is to get it diagnosed. And if anything, to talk to someone who knows or understands why this might be, specifically is what I was talking about before, where there's that loss of light input to your body clock, where the body clock no longer receives a signal to reset itself so that your body rhythms stay in sync with the 24-hour day so that you'll sleep well at night and be alert during the day. And I've tried to tell people to try to start noticing or doing a sleep diary to record how their sleep is changing over time. And this can be vital information for figuring out whether they actually do have this internal problem. Although there could be other problems going on like sleep apnea too that might also impact their sleep at night. So the first thing always is to find someone that can help you and diagnose you to see what the underlying problem is.
Okay, so with that, we'll ask the question, how do we effectively seek treatment when many in the medical community misdiagnose the inability to sleep properly as maybe depression? How do we find a quality sleep center?
Well, that's where I'm coming in, and many other physicians were trying to teach them and educate them about this. Not much work has been paid attention to this particular disorder for one reason or the other. But also, many sleep clinics are geared towards assessing whether you have sleep apnea or not, whether you have narcolepsy. These are particular disorders that have gained much attention in the last 20 years, and a lot of research has gone into them to understand them and treat them. And actual diagnosis and treating the disorder has moved along progressively. But this particular disorder that we would observe in a good majority of individuals who have no light perception, it's kind of been missed. And we're trying to change that so that they will have the ability to go to someone, tell them their troubles with sleep and daytime sleepiness, and then get diagnosed and then treated. So that's the first thing that I've been trying to work through. And the research that I've done over the last 10 years in blind individuals has given me the information for which I can go and speak to the medical community and show that this is very, very prevalent in these individuals and it should be addressed.
Yeah, almost any hospital you can go for apnea, but when it comes to the unique issues that blind individuals face, it's a little more complex. And I know Vanda Pharmaceuticals has conducted some focus groups where they've gotten some people to give their input on questions, so these can be submitted to doctors so that they have a questionnaire to help determine the symptoms that blind folks face and be able to correlate them with some real-world sleep disorders that are unique to those, like you said, that are totally blind or have no light perception.
Yes.
What about eyewear? I don't know that there's been a lot of research done on this, but you mentioned it in our original tech chat. A lot of people, folks like myself, without having physical eyes, or folks who do have eyes, but they don't look the way they want, and they wear glasses or something, some dark shades or something. What have we learned about eyewear either helping or hurting light getting to the body where it needs to be?
Well, in a small percentage of individuals that we've studied who have no light perception, so they can't tell whether the light's on or off, there's been, in the last 10 years, there's been a new discovery within the eye that, other than the rods and cones, there's another layer of cells that contain a particular protein that reacts to light. It's called a photopigment. The name of the photopigment is called melanopsin, but I won't go into the specifics of it. In a study that was done at the Brigham by one of my mentors, Dr. Seisler, he showed that even though that the rods and cones no longer functioned in these individuals, the retina, called the retinal ganglion cell layer, some of these contain this melanopsin, and it causes the cells to react to it, and that message still gets to their body clock. And they found that the subset, since the light gets to their body clock, the light signal gets to their body clock, they can reset their clock, and they sleep well during the night usually. And in one of my recent studies, I had studied an individual who wore scleral shells just basically every day. And when we had done our field study on them where they were doing sleep diaries and doing these urine samples and we would look at their melatonin, we noticed that their melatonin was occurring later and later each week. And this would, from what I saw, that means that they have this non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder. However, I learned later on, we did a particular test to see if light actually gets to the body clock. And this person had that function. Even though they couldn't see the light was actually getting through. And there's only certain ophthalmological or retinal disorders that would allow this to happen. Certain disorders like retinitis pigmentosa, where usually the outer layer of the retina degenerates, the rods and cones degenerate, and the inner nuclear layer and retinal ganglion cell layer are not affected right away or immediately. So the person loses visual perception, but doesn't lose this circadian body clock photoreception. And this individual was wearing scleral shells on a daily basis when they were doing the field study at home. And I realized that by wearing these scleral shells, they were blocking the light getting into their retina and then sending that off to the body clock. And so they had this non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder, even though light could have reset their clock every day. So depending on what kind of eyewear you're wearing, if it's very opaque, where light can't pass through it, chances are, if I'm a sighted person, if wearing sunglasses that are very, very shaded, that can decrease the intensity of the light, which may inadvertently cause a sleep-wake disorder. And sometimes it does happen, maybe, with certain people who have a certain eye disease for a certain amount of time, and they have to wear protective glasses 24/7. They may develop this jet lag-like, non-24-hour sleep-wake disorder.
Okay, so let's talk about the infamous nap. Is that a good thing or bad for us?
Naps can be very good, especially if you're very tired. They can be protective. I never tell people not to take a nap, especially if they're always chronically sleepy. But for people who are relatively healthy and don't have trouble sleeping, naps can always affect how well they'll sleep later on that night. But in any case, where you don't get sufficient sleep over so many days or just even over one night, it's always good to take a nap. It's always a healthy thing to do.
So has it been proven that maybe it's better to set some kind of alarm and not let yourself sleep too long, like maybe limit it to 20 or 30 minutes?
I don't know. That usually is a tough one to answer because there are people who are owls and larks. There's some people who like to stay up late and wake up later, and other people who tend to go to bed early and wake up early. And it's never really the same across people, depending on their preference. So setting the alarm, I always tell people, try to keep a regular schedule, the time that you're going to go to bed and get out of bed. And I have met people who do this, and they say they even wake up before their alarm clock goes off. But then there are other people who this doesn't really happen to. They still have trouble no matter what. And we usually call those either our owls or larks, where they're very they're on an extreme edge of the spectrum of sleep preference. They're very early or very late. And most of us are somewhere in between.
Now, what are some relaxation techniques we can use? There's been some research on music, which normally you think, well, music would be bad. Those driving rhythms would keep you awake. But actually, music is helpful for some folks. So I'm curious, what types of music?
I think, again, that's like a it can be a certain preference, especially when you consider things like stress that can have an impact on how well you're going to sleep. If music or relaxation, particularly even yoga, with a little bit of exercise, if you can do these certain activities, that can reduce your stress. As far as any kind of acute effects of music, I know that there was a particular study that looked at classical music as opposed to rock music or other types of music to help you fall asleep. And the rock music seemed to be best for helping you fall asleep because of the beat, whereas in classical music or jazz, there's not really a consistent beat. There's a lot of changes, and that can be a little bit disruptive to your attention.
And likewise, you might not want to play songs that really drive your emotions. People have certain songs that just make them sad, and they like to abuse themselves and listen to those over and over again. That may not be the way to go either.
Yeah, I don't think so. That wouldn't be the best way. You want to get upset before you go to bed.
No, generally not. Well, before we take questions, I want to, and I think this is going to be more in Willie's court, to really explain what Vanda Pharmaceuticals is looking for in your clinical research studies that are currently taking place. I believe there's three components to this. There's a telephone survey that people can take, and just for completing it, a donation is made to various blindness organizations. There's also the focus groups, which I did one of those, and I think we as a group provided some very helpful info or also compensated for it. And then, of course, there is the actual Tasimeltian research study where you actually do some diaries, and if you have certain criteria that they're looking for, you actually take part in what I believe is a six-month study of maybe using the medication to see if it does assist you. So I'm going to turn it over to Willie and kind of let you explain what Vanda Pharmaceuticals is doing and looking for right now.
Sure, absolutely. I'll focus on really the two things, the survey and then the clinical trial. The third thing you mentioned, the focus groups, we do focus groups and such to better understand, you know, what people are going through from time to time. But I probably won't end up talking about those. I don't know that we have any of those active right now. But the first thing, so we have an 888-800 number set up for people to call in. They can also do it by email, and we'll actually have a web-based survey up shortly, where basically we're just asking a few questions to better understand what people are going through. And for everybody who takes that, we're donating $25 to one of the blind nonprofits. So that's kind of the first step. So anybody who's interested in just kind of making contact, getting some of their initial questions answered, and taking that survey, encourage them to call, and we can give the number and the email at the end and have it listed on the tech chat board. So then, completely optional after participating in that survey, is for those who are interested, they can explore being in a clinical trial that we have ongoing for an investigational treatment for this non-24-hour. And so the process there is if you're interested in that part of it, we will give your name to one of the 23 sites that we now have around the U.S. that are running this study. So physicians and researchers from around the country are the actual local connection for the study. And basically the study involves the first month or so as a diagnostic process, similar to what Joe described in some of the studies they've done at Harvard, basically to understand whether the person's body clock is moving around, and that confirms a diagnosis of non-24-hour. And then if the diagnosis is confirmed, then the person can choose to continue and and will receive either the active investigational medication or a placebo sugar pill. And that lasts for about 6 months. And throughout the 6 months, there's visits into the office for lab work and other efforts. So that's the basic description of. You can either call in to take a survey, and then if you're interested, you can also be consider being in part of the clinical trial. And neither one of those are required for the other to take place, and everything's obviously volunteer and optional. People who do participate in the clinical trial will receive compensation for the time and effort of being in the study. Also, all transportation to and from the facility is provided. And that's often a question people are asking is, you know, I live in downtown Chicago and the research site is out in the suburb. How would I get there? And we provide the transportation, or the sites provide the transportation. And also, there's no cost for any of the medical exams or any other participation, and you are compensated. So that's kind of the basics of the study. There are the main criteria are between 18 and 75, having some level of sleep problems and having total blindness. So those are the three main criteria. Other things, if you're not sure if there's a medication or some other health issue, you know, encourage you to talk with the doctors who are running the study, as well as the doctors, your own doctors, to talk about participation in the study. But there are some other criteria that are in the screening process. But encourage people to call and explore whether they could be part of this study or potentially part of a future study, even if this study doesn't work out.
Just call and ask questions. I think maybe something else you might want to emphasize, Willie, there's such a thing as HIPAA. Maybe people want to make sure that the conversations and questions I ask and the information they provide is confidential, right?
Absolutely. So, I mean, we're under strict controls following HIPAA, and we have the Institutional Review Board, Ethics Board, that's reviewed the survey that we're doing to make sure that all of our systems keep everybody's confidentiality. And, you know, anyone who ever wants to pull their information out in the future, they always have that right, and that's always explained in the start of the process. So all of that, I think, is very well covered, and people should be pretty confident in that. If they do have any questions or concerns, you know, express it to the person that they talked with on the phone, and they can always stop at any time.
First question is, I recently lost all my vision, although I do see some different colored lights.
Dark condition makes it hard for me to sleep.
Does anyone know what's causing this?
Usually it's referred to as phantoms. A person who has lost their vision later in life means that they have... let me just start by saying, when you're first born as a child, as an infant, your brain has to learn how to use all its different capacities, especially the visual centers and your auditory centers dealing with hearing, even your tactile as far as touching and feeling and different sensations of your body. And the brain has to learn this. And in the first years of life, it learns how to use the vision coming in from your eyes. So you don't see with your eyes, your brain sees with your eyes. The perception of it is all translated in your brain. All that information coming from your eyes, all that neural coding is deciphered, and then you have this, they don't understand how it happens, but you have the perception of visual images and colors. When a person loses their vision because of retinal or optic nerve damage, the part of the brain that is still there, the part of the brain that in the occipital lobe, the back part of the brain where this visual information is translated, is still in a way functioning. It's always been used for vision. And they usually refer to these flashes of light that people will see. And they seem very random. And sometimes they could just be white light. And some people have talked about colored lights. And it could be that this is like a rewiring where there's no longer any visual information coming into that area, but other parts of the brain, such as the auditory centers or even some of the thinking centers, might be using that brain area, and it's causing these, I don't want to really call them hallucinations, but it's generating these flashes of light. And there's a book by a man called V.S. Ramachandran. He's at the University of, or he's at Stanford University in California, and he deals with the phantom limb phenomenon, where a person who has had their had an amputation of a limb, and they still have the sensation that the limb is still there. And these certain things can happen when you lose a certain neural input, especially like from the eyes. So it's not uncommon for a person who had vision in their early years of life, lost it later, and experiences flashes of light. It's not uncommon.
Yeah, I actually used to see those as a kid as well. And that's why sometimes you see young blind children putting their finger in their eye, because they think it's helping them to see, because it's stimulating these phantom impulses.
Yeah, if there's still some neural activity in the retina or the optic nerve, you can still elicit these flashes or these images. But I know from people that have been blind their entire life, they've had no light perception even as a child, they don't experience these flashes because that particular part of the brain never developed to generate or interpret such signals. So it just can't generate them without having received such a signal. And there's any, the colors, I wonder if this person might find out whether if these flashes and colors have anything to do with sound or music. There's something called synesthesia, where when they hear certain sounds, they actually see colors. So if they hear certain notes on a piano, they actually see the color flashing across their visual system. And it's kind of like an interconnected neural process.
Wow, very interesting. Well, that's going to put the wraps on our one-hour presentation this evening. I'm going to give each of you two gentlemen a chance for final comments. You can give contact information or any closing thoughts you want to leave our listeners with. I'll start with you, Willie, with Vanda Pharmaceuticals.
I just appreciate having us on, and I think this was a great discussion to hear a little more about sleep problems in general, as well as non-24-hour, which is for the folks who are suffering, and hopefully some of those, or anyone who knows them, can spread the word about this, and this broadcast will be archived on the site, so refer people to listen to it, and hopefully everyone found it educational. Did you want to say the 800 number on the line?
Oh, please do.
So for those who do want to call and do the survey and find out more about the study, the number is 888-389-7033. It's 888-389-7033. And the email and the website with more information on the website are linked on the Tech Chat site.
That's right. The email is info@non24registry.com, and of course you can get all this information at serotalk.com, serotalk.com. Joe, your final comments this evening, sir?
Well, first I want to thank you, Michael, for inviting me to come on again, and I hope I can do it again. And as I said in the past, if anybody would like to contact me to ask me any questions about their sleep, or you can even ask me questions about the sleep study, I'm a co-investigator at one of the study sites. A lot of the techniques that the Vanda is using are based on some of the work I've done in the past. So if anybody has any questions, they can also contact me. My phone number is 617-278-0857. And my email address is jhull, that's J-H-U-L-L, at partners.org. Thank you.
Okay, well, I will add that email address and the phone number again to the show notes, so you can get those at Serotalk, Serotalk.com. Thank both of you gentlemen for joining us this evening. I hope this information has been of use and value to many of our listeners. As great and awesome as we are as individuals, many folks do have occasional downtime or times when we're not at our best because our body just isn't awake and functioning as highly as we'd like it to be. So getting this information, helping us to regulate our sleep, in turn regulates our awake and alert time and our productivity. So I hope many people will take this information to heart and make the most of it. So again, I thank both of you gentlemen, and of course inviting all to join us live every Thursday evening for Tech Chats from 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific U.S. And we'll let Willie go to sleep, who is in London, where I think it's about 3 or 4 in the morning. And we'll see all you folks again next week. So this is Michael Off with my usual. Until we meet again, stay connected and stay directed.
This concludes another Serotalk Tech Chat, powered by Accessible Event, a product of Serotech Corporation, giving the blind, deaf, and deafblind full access to classes, meetings, and webinars using Microsoft Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint slides, and web pages. 508 compliance is just one click away at www.accessibleevent.com. Until we meet again, stay connected and stay directed.